It is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, May 14th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today, we also have another health segment by our reporter, Sharon Hundle, where she discusses the pros and cons of using the HCG hormone as part of a new trend diet.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
The BC Liberal Party will be returning half of the $1,950 in donations that were made by Triumph, the Canadian National Physics Laboratory located at UBC's Vancouver campus in 2011. The money was donated in the form of tickets to fundraising events, but Elections BC has ruled that the money must be returned as Triumph is a registered charitable organization that receives taxpayer dollars. The tickets were purchased so that Triumph's director, Nigel Lockyer, could attend a handful of BC Liberal fundraising receptions in order for him to speak with Liberal MLAs Moira Stilwell and Richard Lee, as well as BC Premier Christy Clark. Lockyer stated that although the lab does not receive any funding directly from the provincial government, he feels lobbying them is still important. Triumph CFO Henry Chen was adamant that no taxpayer dollars were used for the donations and that the money came from a separate stream of revenues held in a non-public account. The story holds special significance for UBC, not only for the Triumph connection, but also because it was the campus newspaper, the UBC, who created much of the initial publicity surrounding the event.
Public consultation has now closed on UBC's Housing Action Plan, which began in 2011 to ensure that more affordable and sustainable housing options are included in UBC's future building plans. UBC has drafted a discussion paper addressing campus housing concerns for students, faculty, and staff, ranging from affordability to variety. The Community Planning Task Group will present the results at the next Board of Governors meeting. Students have also raised concerns about the price of housing in Vancouver. Student loans currently allocate $573 per month for shelter, causing many students to seek housing off campus. UBC plans to advocate to various levels of government in order to bridge this gap. According to the discussion paper, one of the main issues for students is a shortage of beds available on campus. Student Housing and Hospitality aims to add 2,000 student beds on campus by 2016, up from the current 9,000.
University of British Columbia researchers are making bikeability research easily accessible to consumers and city planners by introducing bikeability, quote, heat maps in partnership with Seattle-based WalkScore. Combining data on availability of cycling infrastructure, including bike lanes and trails, topography, desirable destinations, including attractions, shops, and restaurants, and road connectivity, researchers from UBC School of Population and Public Health and Simon Fraser University worked with web developers from WalkScore to develop algorithms to make the information easily accessible online. Heat maps of bike score for 10 Canadian and 10 US cities were launched today during National Bike Month in the US and in advance of Bike Month in Canada. Victoria, Vancouver, and Montreal rate highest in bikeability for Canadian cities, where Minneapolis, Portland, and San Francisco lead in the U.S.
British Columbia's privacy watchdog is demanding the province change four pieces of legislation and in one case scrap a bill altogether because of concerns over personal privacy and government transparency. Information and Privacy Commissioner Elizabeth Denham has sent four critical letters to provincial ministers this month, the most recent on Friday, chastising them for a host of problems in their bills. Denham has asked government to withdraw its Emergency Intervention Disclosure Act, which would let emergency workers get court orders to compel blood samples from people in high-risk situations. Denham also targeted a government bill designed to lower generic drug prices and enshrine a pharmacare plan in law, saying it reduces transparency and gives the health minister too broad an austerity in disclosing personal information.
And those are our UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for your provincial and national headlines.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
The Rio Theatre is your independent East Vancouver theatre, playing first-run feature films, independent film screenings, as well as live events. Every Friday night, there are featured midnight cult classics on the big screen, and no one can beat the Rio for their cheap date Tuesdays. This May, movies are back at the Rio. Fridays at 11 p.m., there's no better place to be than at the Rio Theatre for classics such as Battle Royale, Purple Rain, The Dark Crystal, and Jackie Brown. As always, ticket prices are reduced for midnight movies if you arrive in costume, so dress to impress. Special events this month at the Rio include May 16th, open mic night at the Rio with East Fans Got Talent, starting at 8 p.m. Alan Doyle performing live Wednesday, May 23rd, also at 8 p.m. May 30th, get your nerd on with the live Dungeons & Dragons comedy experience. Join Vancouver's best comedic performers the last Wednesday of every month as they quest for glory and snacks in this live, improvised spectacular. Did we mention that movies are back at the Rio? For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheatre.ca.
Welcome back to CITR News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines. So, first of all, a team of engineers has reevaluated the threat that earthquakes pose to more than 500 BC schools and determined that 152 remain at high risk and will need structural upgrades to make them safe. The team, which includes engineers from UBC's Department of Civil Engineering and the Association of Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of BC, used new assessment tools and procedures to predict how different sections of school buildings in different seismic zones would withstand different types of earthquakes. The new assessment identifies high-priority schools as those that have at least one, quote-unquote, high-risk section requiring structural upgrades, which could mean anything from serious structural renovations to complete replacement of the building. The total cost of the repairs of the 152 high-risk schools have been estimated at $1.3 billion. The remaining 348 schools identified for upgrades have been classified as low or medium risk, meaning they can be made safe without structural upgrades. These lower-risk upgrades will focus more on the contents of the school, such as securing of lighting fixtures and bolting down of water heating systems, rather than the structure of the buildings. Education Minister George Abbott says the 14 priority projects should be completed over the next 2 years, with the remaining 138 schools to receive upgrades over the next 5 to 10 years. In 2005, a provincial report identified 750 schools across BC in need of seismic upgrades to survive a major earthquake, prompting the government to pledge $1.5 billion to fix the problem. Since then, the BC government has spent about half a billion dollars, so a third of this, upgrading 132 schools, which is much less than a third.
The police chief in Sherbrooke, Quebec, is urging people to stay calm as bloody syringes continue to be found in clothing at shopping centers. Since January 20th, 20 syringes containing a small amount of blood have been found needle-side up in pant pockets throughout stores in Sherbrooke. So far, 8 people have been injured as a result of pricking themselves. Police have not been able to identify a suspect, but were able to confirm that DNA found in the last 3 needles belong to the same person. Just who that person is still unknown. In the meantime, Police Chief Gaetan Lab is warning shoppers and staff to be extra prudent and to check pockets carefully before just jamming your hands in there.
The bail hearing for 4 people charged in connection with the smoke bombing of Montreal's metro system last week has been postponed. François Vivier Gagnon, Jean-Vive Vaillancourt, Vanessa Lecuyer, and Roxane Belliel turned themselves in on Friday, accompanied by their lawyers. The 4 were expecting to be granted a bail hearing today, but amid supposedly angry protests, the bail hearings were postponed until May 23rd. A smattering of about 50 people held a demonstration in front of the courthouse in support of the alleged smoke bombers. Emotions between protesters and journalists also hit on an aggressive note when protesters accused the media of being biased and obstructed TV cameras from filming by tossing sheets over the lenses. This apparently led to some moderately angry exchanges. Supporters all cheered wildly when the 4 accused, who were charged Saturday with inciting fear of terrorism as well as conspiracy and mischief over $5,000, left the courtroom. Gagnon was being handed an additional charge for possession of a prohibited weapon for allegedly carrying a knife. The rush hour attacks on Montreal's metro system last Thursday morning paralyzed subway service for more than 3 hours and apparently cost the city millions in lost productivity. Police are still searching for suspects who smoke-bombed the Préfontaine and Jean Talon stations.
Quebec's Education Minister, Lynn Beauchamp, quit her cabinet post today. Beauchamp announced that she is giving up politics entirely, saying she feels she's lost the goodwill of student leaders and done all she can to resolve the strike involving over 175,000 students that has now lasted 14 weeks. Beauchamp made the announcement with Quebec Premier Jean Charest at her side. Charest said that throughout the tuition battle, Madame Beauchamp acted with the full support of her colleagues and added he wishes she'd stay on, but recognizes that this is a decision she must make for herself. Charest reaffirmed that his government is determined to resolve disputes with student groups and added he will swear in a new education minister later today, which has already happened. Quebec Treasury Board President Michel Cochesny was sworn in as education minister about an hour after Beauchamp announced her resignation. Cochesny has already held the post of education minister in the past, from 2007 to 2010. She has participated in recent negotiations with striking student groups, all of which have failed.
So those were your provincial and national headlines here on News 101. But we do actually have one more surprise, also about Quebec. Quebec says the federal anti-crime bill will result in 1,000 additional inmates in provincial jails every day. The estimates are found in internal provincial public security documents obtained by QMI agency. Bill C-10, the Federal Safe Streets and Communities Act, toughens sentences for a variety of offenses. The law reduces the use of conditional sentences, such as house arrest, provides harsher penalties for young offenders, and makes it more difficult to get a pardon. Quebec has opposed the bill from the start and plans to soften provisions whenever possible. Quebec also said it will delay implementation by as much as 7 years. The province predicted Bill C-10 could swell the population of the 18 provincial jails by nearly 20%. The report noted the facilities are already filled to 96% capacity. Federal estimates of the effects of Bill C-10 are lower than those of Quebec. The federal numbers say Bill C-10 would add 2,500 more inmates to provincial jails per year and cost an additional $137 million annually. Justice Minister Jean-Marc Fournier has already told the federal government the province will not top up the $543 million already earmarked for jail renovation, expansion, and construction. We now go to our interview with Michael Bauer, who is a professor here at UBC's School of population and public health, and we're going to be talking about the campaign that we actually mentioned earlier, working with Seattle-based Walk Score. So, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So, it's great to have you here today. What can you tell us, I guess, first of all, for our listeners who may just be tuning in, about what this project was and what these heat maps that you made are?
So, we've actually, as part of a larger group, been studying for a number of years motivators and deterrents to getting more people to cycle. And kind of as a result of our research, we basically wanted to get a publicly easy-to-use tool out there, both for people to determine locations in their city that are sort of more or less favorable to biking, and also for transportation planners to identify areas where they might need to put a little more emphasis on building infrastructure, bike lanes, that kind of thing. Sort of, you know, islands or deserts in a city that where that infrastructure didn't exist. So, so what we did was we actually partnered with a startup called Walk Score. They're pretty well recognized for having a score of walkability, which tells you sort of how walkable your neighborhood is. And we basically tried to take that same concept, use their expertise in web programming, and build Bike Score. So that's kind of what we've just started to and just launched today.
Wow, that sounds like a really cool project and definitely really useful both for, I guess, for people in policy and sort of that urban planning, as well as for people who just want to know more about biking and what's available to them. I guess we do know that Victoria, Vancouver, and Montreal were the highest cities in Canada. Could you tell us what the lowest ones were?
Yeah, so we didn't really emphasize, you know, comparing cities just because we've only taken a snapshot of a few cities. We just picked one per province. So what we're actually trying to emphasize more, which is really the original goal of this tool, is actually looking more kind of within communities, identifying good and bad areas. And once we start, and the hope is that more and more cities across Canada and the U.S., will contribute and actually provide data and will be built into those scores. And once we have, you know, several hundred cities, then I think we could start talking about rankings.
So how do you see, I guess, politicians and people who do, who actually use this data in order to make sort of urban planning decisions, do you see this really taking off and them using it a lot, or is it something you think you'll have to push more?
Well, I hope so. I hope it will really take off. I think, I mean, it's been phenomenal to see actually walk score, walkability, all those terms are actually now, you know, almost part of the common vocabulary. So walk score is actually used by realtors. If they want to sell properties, they say, you know, this is in a walkable neighborhood. People understand what this means. And that's great. Biking actually provides kind of a different level of transportation. You can get farther on a bike. You can only go so far by walking. So it's something that we also think can be attractive to people. And first of all, in deciding where they want to live, identifying if you are interested in biking, but you live in an area that doesn't score well. Now that's sort of a piece of information that you can take to your local government. You can say, we're not really benefiting the way we should. We need some infrastructure because we want to cycle, but we're just not able to because there's not infrastructure. So that's kind of from the public side. And then this is a tool for planners to really see where they're doing a good job and where they're not doing a good job, and even probably to be a little bit smarter in terms of where they put their infrastructure. So, for example, this score considers not just sort of the spacing of, you know, where bike routes would be, which is kind of an obvious thing, but it considers hills, which we know are really important if you're going to bike or not. It also considers destinations, so where do people actually want to go, and areas that there's a lot where there's a lot of density of cafes, restaurants, shops. Those are areas that actually should be served by bike routes, bike infrastructure. So we're hoping that, you know, we can provide kind of an easy-to-use tool that will kind of make decision-making easier.
I guess looking at that and knowing that different criteria, I think places in Vancouver that would probably be higher ranked would be places like Carousel or Kits and so on. Were there any sort of surprise winners that you hadn't expected to see that really actually turned out to be quite good for cycling?
We've just started to sort of look at different cities. I think one thing that's been kind of interesting, and it's more evident in some of the American cities, is for example, Portland. You know, everybody thinks of Portland as being a great place for biking, and it is a great place for biking, but it's really got isolated areas that are fantastic and a lot of areas that aren't so good. And you can contrast with something like San Francisco, which also I was surprised it scored quite high.
It's so hilly.
It is very hilly, but there are sort of flat, you know, kind of sections on ridges and things, and they have really dense bike routes. So you don't have to go more than 3 or 4 blocks, and you can find a bike route. And that's partly just because the way that city is designed, it's just so dense that it's kind of, you know, and obviously they didn't score very well on hills, but, you know, they did for some other, and there are parts that aren't hilly where people can go. So those were some, you know, kind of initial surprises, but we've really just started. We hope that this will actually kind of start the dialogue. You know, everybody knows their own city best, and I think just having the conversation is, you know, is a success.
Definitely. I guess just one final question for you. In terms of that conversation that is going to get started now, where would you like to see people in Vancouver who do have the power to do this planning for cycling infrastructure, and planners who will be thinking about the different destinations? Where would you like to see them taking this conversation next in order to improve Vancouver's?
What we know, you know, so Vancouver has actually put a lot of emphasis on downtown, which is really important, and I think that's great. What we sort of know from our research is that people are willing to go about 4 blocks out of their way to go to bike routes, and that's about it. So really, the whole city, everybody shouldn't have to go more than 4 blocks to get to a bike route, and we're still quite a ways from that. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's really the future that we need to be aspiring towards.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was great talking to you and learning a bit about that.
Sure, my pleasure.
All right, take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that was Professor Michael Bauer from UBC's School of Public Health and Population and Public Health, talking to us about the recent research that came out between UBC, SFU, and Seattle-based startup WalkScore about bikeability heat maps in different cities and how that's hopefully going to affect public planning for infrastructure and so on. So you are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us. We will be right back.
2011 marks the 25th anniversary of the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden since opening in 1986. The Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden is very pleased to have been able to connect cultures and communities for the past 25 years and continue being an arts and cultural hub in the neighborhood and the city. Watch for complimentary specials on the 25th day of every month. There are also blockbuster exhibits, community events, academic conferences, and music and theater productions lined up, plus contests and giveaways. CITR 101.9 FM is proud to be a year-long partner as the Garden celebrates its 25th anniversary. For more information, visit www.vancouverchinesegarden.com.
Show your Friends of CITR card or simply mention that you heard about the garden on CITR to receive $2 off admission.
Get ready, the North by Northeast music.
Have you heard of the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park? Profits support NS Culinary Education Society of BC. Enjoy breakfast on the beach for only $4.95, served daily from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. Say you heard this ad and receive 5% off lunch and dinner items until May 31st, 2012. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, or dinner at the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park and support a local social enterprise.
And welcome back to CITR News, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building on CITR 101.9 FM. We now go to a piece produced by our very own health correspondent, Sharon, who was going to lay down some wisdom for us.
So hi, everyone. Today I was working with one of our new health correspondents, Andrea, who's also a dietetics student. Thanks, Andrea, for helping out with the show today. Since summer is just around the corner, we thought weight loss would be a great area to focus on for the month. Today we're talking about the hormone HCG diet for weight loss. After a friend asked me what my professional opinion is about this drug, I had to look it up. I was very surprised to learn about how popular it is. And if you haven't heard it before, I'll fill you in on all the details. So HCG stands for human chorionic gonadotropin, which is a hormone that occurs naturally during the early part of pregnancy. HCG is what home pregnancy tests looks for. So how does it work? That's a big question. It helps deliver nutrients from mom to baby during development to help the baby grow. But when injected into someone who is not pregnant, it tricks the body into going into overdrive and taking energy from fat reserves in the body, such places as the buttocks, hips, thighs, and abdomen. And these are all problem areas for many people. This is what results in the huge drop in weight. So the hormone is legal for use in Canada, but whether it's safe to use for weight loss is still a question we felt was worth investigating. There is a twist, however. HCG is not the cure-all supplement it seems to be. As we were doing our research, we read that dieters are restricted to eating just 500 calories a day in addition to the shot. So to give you an idea, the average person needs around 2,000 calories per day. So that's a huge reduction in calories. However, some studies have shown that there was no difference between this diet and others that restrict your calories. So the other question that we have to ask is HCG really worth it? Considering the average treatment length is 30 days, four times per year, and it doesn't yield results much different than other diets that restrict your caloric intake, we felt it's not worth all the trouble. If you're considering weight loss for a healthier body or leaner figure, we recommend talking to your doctor and engaging in daily exercise and a balanced diet. It sounds like what we all hear, but it really is the best way to stay healthy and maintain a lean figure. So next week we'll be back to fill you in on some hot activities to do in Vancouver to get your fitness level up. If you have any specific questions relating to fitness, please email news@citr.ca, or if you have any questions or feedback for us, we'd be happy to hear from you. Until then, stay happy and healthy in Vancouver. I'm Sharon for CITR News in Vancouver. Thank you.
And thank you very much for that, Sharon. Always insightful. And now it is time for yet another fantastic forecast from friendly Phil Chang. What do you got for us, Phil?
Oh, thank you, Martin. Good evening, listeners. Moving west to east like most weather patterns, the upper level pressure ridge, which has given us some great weather over the past 2 weeks, is heading inland towards Alberta. The data sensors on the rooftop of our Earth and Ocean Science building is picking up on this trend and projects the pressure continuing to fall in the next few days. On the bright side, active weather isn't anticipated, as it appears the moisture and stability indexes are still in the safe zone. In other words, most of this week should be a mix of sun, cloud, and a light breeze. Now, here is your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, partially cloudy, low of 16. Tuesday, overcast, high of 19, low of 15. Wednesday, partially cloudy, high of 16, low of 12. Thursday, sunny, high of 16, low of 9. Friday, partially cloudy, high of 15, low of 10. So that's your 5-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 12 degrees on the campus in the sub with Iqbal, Martin, Claire, and CJ. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you very much, Phil. Always welcome when you bring us good news like that. For a whole week of warm, sunny, breezy weather. Perfect for sailing. Now is an addendum to our national headlines. We are going to do a quick piece on the BC Liberals, which today introduced legislation that will finally put an end to the HST, although it's still a year in the making. So we will go to that. The BC Liberals have taken another step towards scrapping the dreaded HST that has basically crippled their party.
Kevin Falcon introduced legislation today that specifies how we'll be navigating our way back to the two-tax system. But politics is a slow game, and the changes won't come into effect for another year. Now, it's no secret at this point that the HST has, and will probably continue to be, the bane of the BC Liberals' existence. The HST supplied the platform on which Gordon Campbell was run out of office, and it was a cumbersome weight that Christy Clark inherited and had to drag around as she pleaded with British Columbians to keep the tax in the run-up to the referendum. But it was not meant to be.
First of all, I want to say that while I am disappointed with the results, the public has very clearly spoken, and now is the time to turn the page. And let me be clear about one thing in particular. We will return to the PST with the exemptions that existed prior to the HST. That's what people voted for, and that's what's going to happen.
The legislation introduced today by Finance Minister Kevin Falcon is only the first in a series of bills that will mark the long road back towards a two-tax system, where us consumers will enjoy half the taxes on those really important purchases.
There will be no PST on purchases like food, restaurant meals, bicycles, gym memberships, movie tickets, or for personal services like haircuts, just as it was previously. For the consumer, it will be the same as it was pre-HST. For business, we are introducing some common sense improvements that will make the administration of the sales tax far simpler.
One of those improvements is an online system that'll let businesses track their PST information and remit payments, saving them a lot of paperwork. And this is all well and good, but realistically, when can we finally expect to be done with this unsavory tax talk?
On April the 1st, 2013, as we committed.
Well, that's good timing. So the HST is set to fall just before the BC Liberals do. I know we still have a year before the big election, but it's already starting to heat up. From Mike McDonald leaving his post as principal secretary to run the campaign a year beforehand, to talks about changing the brand name, and of course, those pesky polls, which seem to have some kind of personal vendetta against the BC Liberals. The latest public opinion polls show that the BC Liberals are clinging to 23% approval among decided voters, while the NDP are running away with 50%. But what's even more embarrassing is that the Liberals hold only a 4-point edge over the irrelevant Conservatives. To make a short point, the BC Liberals are in an uncontrollable nosedive. At least that's what the polls suggest. But then again, the polls told us beyond a doubt that the Wild Rose Party would surely form the next government in Alberta. So, polls aren't foolproof. In any case, Christy Clark and her posse are in dire straits. What got them in this unenviable position? All the HST provided the boot that kicked them in the gutter. They've dropped the ball elsewhere as well. The BC Liberals just will not take a stance when it comes to pipelines on the coast. Now, to be honest, we all more or less know how the current government feels about pipelines. But they won't just come out and support them.
The NDP's approach to this and deciding that they're going to prejudge it, they're going to play politics with it, has got to scare a lot of job creators and employers out of the province, and I am just not going to go down that path.
Oh yes, it's a very fashionable time to be taking shots at the NDP, especially if you're a Liberal of any stripe. But even old Christy has to stand at a distance, in stupefied awe at King Mudslinger Kevin Kruger, who gathered all the legislative press agents last week as an audience for a lengthy and senseless tirade.
I think John Van Dongen suffers from delusions of grandeur. This guy stands up in the legislature and yammers on about his integrity. So where's the integrity when you're the minister responsible for public safety and you rack up a string of speeding tickets as long as your arm? There's, you know, integrity is all or nothing. It's nothing in that. And Adrian Dix could buy a transit pass very easily. He wouldn't need to worry about whether he lost a ticket for the day or not because he should be able to produce his pass. But oh, he forgot that day, and oh, he accepts full responsibility. Well, it's just baloney. When we talk about that memo that he forged when he was Glenn Clark's chief of staff, and he says, and the NDP say, that's old news. It's not old news. It's a pattern, as far as I'm concerned, of dishonesty. So between John Van Dongen and Adrian Dix and the ridiculous John Cummins, there's this conspiracy to try and discredit our premier. It isn't fair. I don't think she's been given a fair shot at all. I don't think Gordon Campbell was given a fair shot.
You don't need a conspiracy to discredit any politician, Kevin. Although he might have something in saying that Clark hasn't been given a fair shot. The seamlessness with which Christy Clark shouldered all that unspent resentment aimed at Campbell and his cabinet is absolutely astounding. When she took over the premiership, she'd been retired for a couple of years, had almost nothing to do with anything Gordon Campbell did in his short-lived third term. But the hostility was swiftly directed towards Clark, which isn't necessarily unfair. Anyone silly enough to want to lead any political party deserves what they get. But there is legitimacy in saying Clark wasn't given a fair shot. She launched her triumphant return to politics by taking over a sinking ship, and it's only sunk deeper since she's taking over. There's still a year before the election, and a lot could happen in that time. Maybe the BC Liberals have a trick up their sleeves. But if they want to stick around for a fourth term, it'll have to be something more substantial than a name change. If all their tricks are superficial, we can save taxpayer dollars by consolidating the farewell parties for both the HST and the Liberals. They belong with each other.
Thank you, as always, to Marty for that insight into the local political situation. We are now going to take a quick break, but do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
The BC Liberals have taken another step towards scrapping the dread.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This May in Discorder, sit down for a chat with local thrash punk sensations New Sensei. Get well acquainted with Peace before their new album drops. Find out if Weed the Band is better than The Substance. And discover the response from members of Prestronaut on the controversy surrounding bands and crowdsourced funding. As always in Discorder, get your healthy dose of Venue News, Filmstrip, take a look at our beautiful calendar, browse the always changing CITR program guide, tech up bits of Mark DeLong's art project on your bedroom walls, take in some reviews of music both recorded and live, and all the other goodies you know and love. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
And welcome back to CITR News. We are broadcasting live from the Student Union Building right here on campus at UBC. And it is now time for your international headlines. Greece's president is to convene a broader meeting with the heads of several political parties on Tuesday in a final push to find agreement on forming a government more than a week after elections gave no party a majority in parliament. The radical left coalition, Syriza Bloc, which finished second in May 6 elections with 16.8%, announced late on Sunday that it would refuse to join any coalition government that did not agree to scrap controversial austerity measures mandated by Eurozone partners. President Carlos Papoulias met with the heads of the conservative New Democracy, socialist PASOK, and Democratic Left parties today in the eighth day of talks to resolve the deadlock. The leaders said the president had suggested creating a government of technocrats or personalities that will convene another meeting with the heads of more parties on Tuesday to seek support. If no deal can be reached, elections must be called for next month. The political uncertainty has roiled European markets and left Greece's continued participation in the euro in serious doubt.
In some more super exciting news, this Saturday, a rocket is scheduled to lift off from Cape Canaveral, Florida, and carry cargo but no people to the International Space Station. But if all goes as planned, that morning will mark something transformative for the space industry, a victory for capitalism and what has been for decades a government-run enterprise. The capsule, built by Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, or SpaceX for short, would be the first commercial spacecraft to make it to the space station, and many observers view its launching as a starting gun in an entrepreneurial race to turn space travel into a profit-making business in which NASA is not necessarily the biggest customer. I want to be a customer. Already, there are some hints of how the era of commercial space travel might unfold. Companies like Virgin Galactic XCOR, and Space Adventures are booking passengers on suborbital joyrides to space, promised for dates within the next few years, and hundreds of people are signing up. And already there are celebrity tie-ins. Among the people who have signed up for Virgin's first flights are Ashton Kutcher, Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, Tom Hanks, and Katy Perry.
For more international headlines, we now go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails agreed to an Egyptian-mediated deal today to end their protest. Rami Al-Maghari has more from Cairo.
Under the deal agreed today at Ashkelon Prison, those inmates held in solitary confinement will be moved to the general population within 72 hours. Further, all prisoners will receive better medical care and be allowed family visits and phone calls. And according to Hamas official Saleh Al-Aruri, the agreement also states that Israel shall either release administrative detainees who have served their imprisonment terms or set up trials for them. Israel holds more than 300 Palestinians under so-called administrative detention. Many of them have spent 2 to 3 years without charges or trial. For the past 4 weeks, more than 1,500 Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails have been on hunger strike, a few for as long as 77 days. Two of the hunger strikers are said to be in a critical condition. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Cairo.
Tension created by the ongoing violence in Syria sparked clashes in Lebanon for a third day today, where five people have died in street fights between Alawites and Sunni Muslims. Alawites largely support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who continues to rule the country after 14 months of violent repression of both civilians and his opposition. In central Syria, as many as 23 government troops died today in fighting in Rostan, and the Free Syrian Army says nine others were also killed in the shelling. And the European Union expanded sanctions today for the 15th time, freezing the assets of five more individuals and companies believed to be funding the Assad regime. A senior leader of the Lord's Resistance Army remains in custody today after his capture by Ugandan troops on Saturday. Major General Caesar Kellum was caught along with at least one wife and eight children. A 5,000-member African Union force is trying to contain the 100-strong LRA and its leaders, including Joseph Kony and two others sought by the International Criminal Court. They are charged with rape, mutilation, and murder, as well as conscripting children to serve as soldiers and sex slaves during more than 20 years of brutal rebellion. In Yemen, military warplanes and ground forces attacked what they call al-Qaeda positions in Abyan province. 16 rebels and 11 troops died. And according to one military official, an airstrike today mistakenly fired at civilians. Two kids were hurt. On Saturday, suspected U.S. forces carried out a third drone strike this month. 11 people died. The pace of drone strikes in Yemen has increased in recent weeks. Yesterday, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein said she hopes that U.S. forces will be able to kill a Yemen-based man suspected of making bombs for the terrorist group. This weekend, tens of thousands of people across Spain marked the first anniversary of the Indignados, or outraged movement, in street mobilizations and public forums. In Madrid, Luis Perez reports.
Chants of the outraged have once again flooded the streets of Spain as supporters of the Indignados movement began occupying public spaces in 80 cities over the weekend. They kicked off a series of actions seeking to reform the country's political and social powers in a more horizontal and democratic structure. During the first 2 days, participants submitted over 7,000 proposals in categories like politics, economy, education, and health. In Madrid, over 70,000 people participated in the opening march, which concluded in Puerta del Sol, the central square that hosted last year's month-long camp. This year, the local government prohibited camping in the plaza and police arrested 18 people who decided to stay overnight. Critics of the May 15th movement say that the worsening of Spain's crisis means the outreach have failed, but supporters like David disagree.
This emerged and developed spontaneously. We didn't have to accomplish anything during this last year, so we haven't succeeded or failed. We simply continue.
Luis Perez, FSRN, Madrid.
In Mexico, the remains of one of the worst massacres in recent years were left along a highway Sunday morning. Shannon Young reports.
The dismembered parts of 49 people were abandoned along a highway that connects the industrial hub of Monterrey to the border city of Reynosa. The identities of the victims will be hard to establish because their heads, hands, and feet were not among the remains left along the road.
Por eso pensamos que
Nuevo León State Attorney General Adrián de la Garza said the victims could be migrants, given that local police haven't received a large number of missing persons reports in recent days. The act of dumping bodies in a single place has become an increasingly common signature of territorial disputes between organized crime groups. While Sunday's incident is the largest of its kind to date, it's the third time so far this month bodies or body parts of 14 or more people have been left in a single location. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those headlines.
We now go directly back to FSRN for more news stories of the international variety.
Civilian deaths are one of the issues activists will highlight this week as the city of Chicago prepares for the NATO summit. Peace and human rights advocates are also calling attention to foreign policy in Afghanistan, education in public schools, and corporate tax rates. While new city and federal security plans are unveiled in anticipation of protests, Chicago residents and activists are planning events, summits, and opportunities to counter the NATO agenda. FSRN's Lisa Matuska has more.
Leading up to the gathering of world leaders, Chicago groups have organized alternative events, including a people's summit, marches, and teach-ins, all focusing on the international implications of NATO's meeting, as well as tying local issues to war and global economic spending. Andy Thayer is an organizer with the group Coalition Against the NATO G8 War and Poverty Agenda, also known as CanGate.
And now we're going to have a global gathering of the 1% here in Chicago. It is not only an opportunity, but it's frankly an obligation for those of us who care about these issues to make our way to Chicago if we're not already here. It really is not a situation to be missed, because we have a unique opportunity to really push back against the 1%.
CanGate and Occupy Chicago organized the People's Summit this past weekend. Brian Bean is an activist who's been planning the alternative events.
The week of action, though it's 10 days, will begin with the People's Summit, which is sort of a two-day educational sort of forum of all types of different ideas about sort of like the world that we may want to have.
The People's Summit included a series of lectures, workshops, and concerts. Organizers said hundreds attended the event, which took place on two floors of a large warehouse space on Chicago's South Side, just a few miles from the site of this weekend's NATO meetings. Discussions covered a variety of topics, from NATO and U.S. imperialism to self-care for activists and protesters. One of those attending was Christine Karch, an organizer from Germany who works with a group called No to NATO.
Of course, we want to analyze the issues and the new strategy of NATO, and see how we can stop and how we get the troops home from Afghanistan at all. This is the most important war for NATO, and how we can avoid other wars of NATO like they have done in Libya.
Karch said more people from her group in Germany will be coming to Chicago this week to participate in another alternative gathering, the Peace Summit, taking place on Friday and Saturday on Chicago's North Side. Throughout the week, Occupy Chicago has also planned events. Activists are highlighting a different theme each day and attempting to localize the discussions to Chicago. Occupy activist Bean says their first day of actions will focus on education, including Mayor Rahm Emanuel's attack on teachers' contracts and the push to close public schools in low-income neighborhoods of color.
This battle has particular importance in Chicago, and so we're going to highlight that particular struggle of talking about underserved schools, and that, you know, we have the funding to be able to do that, but instead we're going to spend $55.5 million on NATO coming here.
Activists began planning protests back in August 2011 when it was announced that Chicago would host both the NATO and G8 summits back-to-back, a pairing of superpower meetings that hasn't happened since 1977. Since their initial planning, they've had to jump through an array of bureaucratic hoops in getting permits and information about security zones. The first major blow came in January when the city announced a new ordinance that clamped down on protests.
You have to list in your application any sign, banner, sound equipment, or quote-unquote attention-getting device that requires two or more people to move or carry it. So we're supposed to predict in January, when we applied, every single sign that requires two or more people to carry it. It's obviously a totally unconstitutional provision.
The original permit was granted for May 19th, the day of the G8 summit. But when President Obama decided to move that meeting to Camp David, the group tried to get a new protest permit for the 20th, the day of the NATO summit. Initially, the city refused, but gave in following legal pressure. Sunday's march will be led by the group Iraq Veterans Against the War, who will be turning in their medals to the NATO heads of state. National Nurses United has also had problems getting a permit for a march on Friday, calling for a tax on international financial transactions. The group had a permit to march to Daley Plaza, a highly visible area in Chicago surrounded by political and corporate headquarters. But last week, the city tried to pull the permit because of high expected attendance. Late Friday, the parties compromised. The nurses can hold a rally, but it is no longer slated as a march. Bean, who is working with Occupy to find accommodations for visiting protesters, says he doesn't like the way the city and mainstream media are portraying demonstrators.
They always want to paint protesters as violent, and that has a very particular function, and that function is to demonize dissent and to scare people from coming out to a march that, since the very beginning, has been slated as a family-friendly march where you can bring your grandmom and your dog. And so they want to sort of scare people away from that because they realize our power. And the very fact that they moved from the G8 from Chicago to sort of Fort David demonstrates that they are aware of the power collectively that we have.
The Secret Service has announced a security perimeter that is roughly a block in each direction that surrounds the McCormick Place Convention Center, a giant, complex series of buildings that sits on Lake Michigan, just south of the downtown loop. And since May 1st, fully armed federal agents have been patrolling an area of federal buildings in Chicago called the Red Zone, a presence which will continue through the summit. While the permit for the big march on Sunday, May 20th is secured, some organizers say they wouldn't be surprised by last-minute changes from the city or the Secret Service. Lisa Matuska, FSRN, Chicago.
Each mother... During the conflict in Libya, NATO airstrikes killed dozens of civilians that to this day have still not been officially acknowledged or investigated. One strike on August 8, 2011, in the village of Majer killed 34 civilians and wounded more than 30. That's according to a report released today by Human Rights Watch, which documents a series of NATO strikes that killed 72 civilians, including 20 women and 24 children. For more, we're joined by Fred Abrahams. He's special advisor at Human Rights Watch and principal author of the report. He joins us from New York. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you so much.
You investigate 8 specific bombings where civilians were killed in Libya. First, talk about the strike in Majer in August 2011, which killed 34 civilians. What did survivors say happened on that day?
Well, the Majer strikes are the most serious incident of civilian casualties caused by NATO, about 34 deaths. And I was actually in Tripoli at the time and learned about it. We went right to the site the very next day. And what was surprising is, first, all of the survivors and the witnesses, they said that there was no military activity at the site. There was no Gaddafi security forces, no communications equipment or other reasons that NATO would have targeted it. They were all civilians, they said. And we also found no evidence, searching through the rubble, of any signs or indications that would have rendered this a legitimate military target. That is, no ammunition or weaponry or signs of military personnel. So the key question in Majer is why did NATO strike there? And to that question, we still don't have a satisfactory answer.
And is it clear what kind of weapon NATO used in that strike?
It is clear that NATO used a what's known as a GBU-12. This is a precision-guided munition. It is a 500-pound bomb, and we found remnants of the GBU-12. They may have used other munitions as well, but we know the GBU-12 was used very frequently in the Libya campaign. And what's unique about this is it's an incredibly accurate weapon, and it also has an infrared optics system so that the bomb is guided right to the target. And what's significant there is that if the pilot or the person who launched the strike, the person would have seen most likely what was happening on the ground. It has a high degree of clarity, and if they were unable to distinguish between civilians and combatants, if they saw people on the ground and weren't sure that they were combatants, then the strike should have been canceled or diverted.
And as you chronicle in the investigation and the report, there was a strike after the initial strike that affected those who were going to help survivors or help those who were caught in the rubble. Is that right?
That's correct. In Majer, there were a number of strikes, four, in fact. And
thank you very much to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily news and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that was our program for May 14th, Monday, which is today. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments or get involved or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast or listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Martin Lumlin. Today's show was produced by Iqbal and CJ. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you very much for listening and stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands.